Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Big Ticket Variety and iHeart's Movie Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Today, I have two guests. First up is Taron Egerton. He's telling all about his Oscar-buzzy work starring as Elton John in Rocket Man. He also reveals the most surprising thing he learned about the legendary musician and what it was like joining Elton for a night of singing in Joni Mitchell's living room. Plus, Taron opens up for the first time about what he thinks went wrong with his Robin Hood movie. Then later, Aldous Hodge. The actor talks about his Gotham Award-nominated work as an inmate on death row in the upcoming indie Clemency and acting opposite Alfred Woodard. It's all coming up after the break. Stick around. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Now here's Rocket Man star Taron Egerton.
It's a really nice burger earlier that I keep thinking about.
Really?
So much so that I am thinking of maybe having another one.
Listen, I'll be coming home from a late night thing, and my husband's home, and he's very healthy. Yeah. I'm like, I'm just gonna.
You
stop.
Look like you don't look like you eat junk.
I eat junk.
Do you?
I do.
You're one of those really annoying people who can just eat.
I used to really be that annoying person. Like, I was this tall when I graduated from high school. I was 118 pounds. I mean, I look like it's ridiculous. But I'll be coming home and I'm like, I'm just going to go to McDonald's.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw out all the wrappers on the street. So not on the street, but in a
trash can. Yeah, yeah.
So he does not see. Yeah. And then I'll get in the car. He's like, what's this French fry on the floor?
Yeah.
I'm like, what am I going to stop at midnight to get a salad?
It tastes so good when it's forbidden as well.
Yes, doesn't
it?
It's better. Thank you. Okay, just tell me, first day on set, Rocket Man, what was it like?
First day on set, it was, I was nervous, obviously, very daunted by the whole prospect, but quite, you know, it felt like a real moment in my life because, you know, I knew that this was going to be a film that obviously lots of people would see and people would be curious about. And we sort of hit the ground running, really. The first thing we filmed was all the stuff at the Troubadour. And
that is not just...
Yeah.
That's like major.
Yeah, major. So the first day we did my freak out backstage. Wow. Which was a really odd place to start because tonally... It's one of, you know, Elton has a few mad moments in, mm-hmm. in our movie. I think he's had a fair few in his life. But tonally, that's a really odd moment because it's such an extreme reaction. Mm-hmm. It's an extreme moment in the, you know, the chronology of the character.
Right.
And at the end of the day, I sort of was a little bit unsure about what the movie we were making was because mm-hmm. it felt quite heightened. And the movie is heightened, but that's one of the more heightened moments, right. I would say. And the second day we were doing Crocodile Rock and, I really, you know, in the script, it's just Elton walks across the stage, performs a song, everyone floats off the ground. And so I planned in advance. I knew that I wanted to kick the stool over mm-hmm. and I knew as well that I wanted to put my foot on the piano, so much so that I had the sound editor put that noise in the temp track.
Wow.
So I sort of choreographed a bit of a routine. Mm-hmm. But those couple of days, I think once we'd done, the first day after we'd done the freak out, the moment of madness backstage, I felt quite wobbly. I sort of didn't quite know what we were doing. and I couldn't tell if I was any good. But after the Crocodile Rock day, I really felt that I knew where we were headed and what right. we were trying to do because, you know, if Elton's happy anywhere, it's on stage, I think.
So you're wearing those shoes, those platform, those
silver numbers.
How, how did that just probably just completely changed how you walked into a room?
100%, yeah, no doubt about it. I think, you know, when he's asked backstage, what on earth are you wearing? And he says, my stage gear. I really wanted that moment to be, I didn't want the freak out to in any way seem about that, you know.
Right, right.
Elton is completely assured about what he wears. I was sat in the back of the car with him a couple of days ago. He was talking to a friend of his who is a well-known jeweler, Laurie Rodkin, and he was just saying, you know, I want you to make me a spider, a brooch, massive, this big. And he's just got a certainty about things, about lots of things, but he has a particular certainty in relation to what he wears.
How was your back after wearing those clunkers?
I was okay. The thing that's amazing about his costumes, not his costumes, his stage wear, my costumes, is that it's very empowering.
Mm-hmm.
I think even an oversized Donald Duck outfit can be empowering, right. And I think that's what...
Because you got to be pretty confident to wear an 100%. Oversized Donald Duck costume.
I think there's something about it, there's something of the peacock about it, and I feel like it's an armor. I think as well with Elton, a lot of it's to do with the fact that he, I think as a young man, did not feel very... I don't think he felt very sexy, mm-hmm. frankly. Of course, he is very sexy. His confidence and his persona, and he's had his moments of being aesthetically very attractive as well. But I don't think he felt it,
mm-hmm.
and I think those crazy costumes went some way to compensating.
Oh, for sure. So tell me about the day you get the phone call, you get the role.
Yeah.
Do you call your mom first? Who do you call?
I mean, it felt like such a. It was a very gradual thing. It didn't really feel like there was one decisive moment. But of course, my girlfriend and my family have endured me talking endlessly about this for a number of years. But they're all super proud and they all love the film. I think they all feel it's their favorite, I think, of the things that I've been a part of.
But you get the role, then you go to bed that night.
Yeah.
You try to sleep. You wake up the next day and you're like, shit, I gotta go play.
I know. It's a lot. And I think all you can do is try and park that feeling and try and enjoy yourself and do as much work as you can.
Right.
But it's one of those parts and one of those things where you kind of can't think, you just have to put your head down and run at it, and right. That's what I did, and that's why I think that's why Dexter made Crocodile Rock the first thing. In fact, I know it's why he made it the first mm-hmm. thing. There's no easing yourself into playing Elton John.
Right.
You just the extremity of who he is, I think you just have to head down and run at it like a bull, really, and hope that all the work you've done and all of the planning and all of mm-hmm. the time spent with him and all of the endless months in studio will all inform something that will feel believable.
What was your favorite day on set? Your favorite moment?
Favorite moment? The scenes that I'm especially proud of. The scene where I meet Bernie, I really love.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt very much like I just felt that it's such a big moment for those two men, and I of course the whole time we were making the movie I was thinking about their reaction to it, and right. I felt that Jamie and I complimented each other well mm-hmm. that day. But favorite days on set. There are so many days that I loved and enjoyed. I really mm. loved performing the days that required me to perform as him. But equally, this is, for me as an actor, I think I'd been yearning to sort of slightly... I've played the things I've done in my 20s, namely Kingsman, Eddie the Eagle, my doomed Robin Hood movie that I made.
You still say the name?
Yeah, I try not to bring it up if I can. But I felt like I'd been yearning to explore slightly darker territory. Mm-hmm. I still feel that way, just a sort of slightly more, stories and characters that are a little less archetypally sympathetic, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And I felt that Elton represented that opportunity for me. So I actually relished the days where I was required to perform something that was kind of, dark or tumultuous, right. or challenging in that way. But you know, the great joy of this job was that it just afforded so many different opportunities and allowed me to flex so many different muscles.
So what was the hardest day?
The hardest day. I do think that day, the day where we shot the restaurant stuff towards the end of the movie with my mother and then with Bernie as well, I found that draining because it's him, you know, he's really, really, really miserable at that moment and really, you know, drunk and high and just miserable. And it's also a really sad moment because it really jeopardizes the relationship with Bernie, Alan's behavior there. I was always a passionate defender of the scene from the script. Because there was contention at the time about whether it goes too far, because, you know, I can't remember what I say in it, but it's something like, you've never been there for me. I think I say, can I swear on this?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I say, I don't get to sit around all day chewing on the end of a fucking pencil. Mm. It's a really awful thing to say to someone you care about, you know?
Right.
But that day was taxing because it's, you know, it's just not a nice scene, you know?
Right.
But not that I've, you don't really feel, you know, I'm not method or anything,
right,
but you know, being negative for a whole day or in a negative
it's
situation,
take its toll.
It does take its toll a little bit, yeah.
Obviously you spent a lot of time with Elton, we've read about that, you've talked about it. What did you learn about him that just surprised you the most?
I mean, there's so much. There are details of his drug use that are disturbing, you know, that probably don't need repeating. And also, it's not the most interesting thing to say, but I mean, the one thing that really genuinely surprised me, getting to know him more and more, is knowing how shy he is, really, and how much of it is a sort of show,
right,
and an adopted persona.
Mm-hmm.
At the core of him, he's a shy person.
Right.
And at the core of him, he's quite a sweet, uncertain person. It blows my mind now how he still asks me how he's done when he performs or something. You
really?
Know? And with a genuine kind of, well, I don't want to say worry, but, you know, he's, I think part of the reason for his
some of that is healthy.
I mean, yes, I think that's what it is. I think that's really one of the many glorious things about Elton is that, and I think it probably, you know, contributes to his success, but I don't think he thinks anything's granted, and I certainly don't think he ever thinks he nails it automatically. And I think that bit of uncertainty probably keeps you
grounded.
Yeah,
it really does.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're at the Cannes Film Festival. You do that carpet, which is one thing right there,
yeah,
standing next to Elton, but then
I know.
You're on a stage.
I know. As if I didn't have enough to do that day. I do a day of press, go to the premiere, sit next to Elton John, and they go, oh, we'd like you to sing afterwards with him on the beach.
You've got it. I mean, I
definitely earned my money there, didn't I?
But I don't care how confident someone is or how long they've been in the business. That has to be
a
mindfuck.
Yeah, mate. Yeah, massively. And just just not, you know, the thing to remember, and I don't want to be too, you know.
Wait, I have to set it up for you, though, because we all know it's happening, right? Of course,
yeah.
Paramount won't confirm it, but there's a stage.
There's a stage and there. It's got Rocket Man in lights
so
written above
we're
it.
We're literally, we're like, we can't figure out where is the best place to stand because they have this whole pit.
Yeah.
So we thought that pit was blocked off for security. All of a sudden, they open that pit and people start running. I was literally climbing on the side and I'm like wobbling. It was hysteria.
It was, people were excited. I mean, the other thing to remember, not to be, you know, to pity myself too much, but, you know, most singers, performers, cut their teeth performing to three or four people in sleepy, you know, bars for many years before they get their big audience. I mean, you know, I didn't really have that luxury. So I did feel I was being thrown in at the deep end a little bit. I have to say that there is a lovely thing about him. I've sang, you know, apart from Elton a few times as well.
Yeah, like the other night at the Greek
Theater. Yeah, yeah.
And who was in the audience?
There was a few cool people there, but Pete Townsend was, and my love Joni Mitchell was there as well, which is very, very cool. But there's something about him. He's actually very calming. He's a very calming influence on stage. There's something very solid and dependable and assured about him that really relaxes me.
So you were relaxed on stage? You looked relaxed. You didn't look nervous.
If you watch the four times I've sang with him, you can see me getting progressively more relaxed. you can see it, you know, from Tiny Dancer at the Oscars party, where I'm quivering. and then the next time would have been at Cannes, where I'm a little more relaxed, probably with the help of a few French beers. And then I went out and sang your song with him at the start of the UK leg of his tour in Brighton. And then last week we did Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me.
So basically you've gone on tour with Elton John, is what you're saying.
But you could put it that way, yeah.
So then we bring you to the Oscars. There is an original song on the soundtrack.
Yes.
That could be up for, you know, all his songs that he's done before, that can't be up for an Oscar. Mm. You could be performing on the Oscar stage without the
job. Yeah. You were the first person who's actually floated that as an idea. God, that's a thought, isn't it? I mean, we'd have to have a conversation about that, because that would be a lot. That would really be a lot.
What does it feel like to hear Oscar buzz? Being on those Oscar lists,
it doesn't feel like my life, you know. It doesn't feel like my heart still flutters when I land in LA, you know. And this is my 10th trip here this year, I believe. You know, it still has a kind of twilight heady magic to it. It still feels like something very far away. You know, I didn't land in America until I was 25, you know.
Wow.
Barely did air travel when I was a kid, you know. I was raised by a single parent. We didn't own our home. We moved a lot, you know. To be here now, I mean, a week ago today I sang for Joni Mitchell in her living room. You know, my
life. I believe
life,
that was after the Amphis screening, right?
Yeah. Okay. Straight after, yeah.
Hold on. You're not going to just drop that?
Yeah.
You sang for Joni Mitchell in her living room.
I did, yeah. It's been an amazing week. And that was.
I'm getting chills, and I wasn't there.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. Bonnie Raitt was there, Elton John, myself, Brandi Carlile. It was truly amazing.
Brandi Carlile was one of my.
Well, I saw her do Blue last Monday, the whole album, and it was just the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. But yeah, but I only say all this to illustrate the fact that, you know, my life does feel unrecognizable, and those lists and those conversations, to be mentioned, is the most wonderfully validating thing, you know, and it really is the stuff of dreams, that prospect.
How are you going to keep that grounded? How do you keep that in perspective?
Well, I think, I mean, and, you know, it's only talk. There's no, you know, those things are still a way away, and if it were to happen, it would be, I mean, beyond anything that I've experienced before. But I mean, remaining grounded is not something that worries me, because I feel like I have great people in my life. I have really great people in my life, and I have a great team, and I have a great family, and I have great friends, and a lot of those people have been in my life for a very long time.
That's great.
And you know, they were all there with me in Cannes, most of them, you know, and all of these wonderful experiences and things that have happened in my life, I've had the great privilege to be able to share with those people, and it makes it all the more, I mean, it, you know, quadruples how good it all is. Quadruple isn't enough. It's just, for some reason, four was the biggest number I could think of. But you know, I
infinity.
Yeah. So yes, I'm very lucky. I have great people, and I feel like I'm sharing this incredible journey with them.
So when you first were talking to them about the movie, it's not a traditional biopic.
No.
You know, it's you know, there's fantasy, there's realism, there's a mix. It becomes a musical at one point. Did you know that was the right way to do it?
I just thought it. No, I wasn't nervous. You know what it is stylistically. I read the script. You know, the original script has gone through lots of iterations and drafts. But you know, you have a very the scripts that I've read that I've loved. You know, you have a very visceral reaction to them. And I had a very just the opening line. You know, I'm a sex addict and a cocaine addict and a bulimic and a shopaholic. You read that and you're like, oh, this is going to be good. You know, this is a character worth playing. You know, who's this guy? And
let's not forget what you're wearing.
Yeah, exactly. I think the only anxiety I had, the only paranoia I had was that, you know, the film is a specific thing. It's a fantasy, but it's also a very candid warts and all telling of a famous person's life. And the only thing that worried me was that I thought if and it never happened, I'm so pleased to say, if the temptation to tamper with it for box office potential, if that happened,
right?
I've just felt that corrupting the DNA of what it is, and those things are in its DNA. Mm-hmm. I knew it would collapse because it's envisaged and imagined as, you know, something that isn't kind of sanitized or made to be commercially at the expense of its artistic integrity, but that never happened.
That's great.
I think, you know, there was everyone really held on to their integrity. Paramount were just amazing collaborators and supporters, and it really turned into the movie that I hoped it would be. And I'm so pleased and proud of it. You know, I still feel like it could be. It's there now, it's done. You know, no one can take it away, but I still sometimes worry that it's going to be taken away because I was so passionately invested in it.
Right.
I'm just so pleased that it turned into what it did.
So how do you top this?
I don't know.
I know that there's
I'm not going to try.
I know there's all the Wolverine speculation, which, you know, is just by association more than anything.
I think so, yeah. I think so. You know, I just want to play interesting characters. That's all I want to do. I'm happy to do it in small movies. I'm very happy to do it in big movies. I, you know, just want to keep doing things that are different and surprising, and I feel stimulated by it. I don't want musicals to characterize my career, but I also want them to be a part of it. So I'd like to do more of that.
So why didn't Robin Hood? Why didn't people get it? What happened?
It's very complicated. You know what? I don't care. It absolutely was not the movie that I signed up to make.
Really?
No, it's not. It was different at the inception of it, at the idea of it. It was pitched to me in a different way, and I think it was made by committee, and I think it lost its vision.
When do you realize that? Do you not realize that until the final cut, or is it happening during filming?
I wasn't very happy on the set. Mm. I didn't have a very happy time making it. And I felt like no matter how much energy I put into it, it never... Because normally I find that when things aren't good, and you're not having a good time creatively, it's normally something in my attitude, and I just felt like no matter how much effort I doubled down on into it, it never became a happy place to be. That's me being very candid. I've not really spoken about that before, but then I didn't really know what it was going to turn into. I think the director's super talented, and everything else he's done I've absolutely loved. But when I went to, it's the first time I saw it, I just didn't really recognize it.
Wow.
I didn't really recognize it from the movie that I'd signed up to make, you know. It was originally going to be scored by like contemporary music and stuff. And it just didn't really become what I wanted it to become.
So what's the one film you could watch over and over again and you never get bored?
Oh,
Shaun of the Dead is one that I return to. Over. Yeah. Oh, did you mean something that I'm in?
No.
Oh, no, no, no.
Or if it is a movie you're in.
Yeah. Shaun of the Dead is one that I have watched over and over.
Why
and over
is that?
Again. Because you see, it's made in such a way that it's very, very layered. So you can watch it time and time again and see different things in it. And I just think the performances are lovely in it. And it's very, very funny. I also have a real soft spot for zombie movies as a genre. And then other things that I've watched over and over again, like David Fincher's stuff, The Social Network, I've seen many, many times.
Really?
And yeah, I just think it's...
Of all David Fincher ones, Social Network,
I
huh?
love it for a couple of reasons. I think they're all brilliant in it, and I love the music. It's one of those films where I listen to the soundtrack on its own.
Right.
I think the soundtrack to The Social Network is amazing. Yeah, I mean, there's loads of things, but there's a handful.
When was the last time you cried at the movies? Are you a crier?
Do you know, funnily enough, the biggest emotional reaction I've had in recent times was, I was telling you about Brandi Carlile.
Yep.
I went to see her do Blue,
mm-hmm.
and it was wonderful and beautiful. Never a false note, never a false move. It was just stunning, and her band and everything, it was perfect, perfect, perfect. It got to A Case of You, which, if you know Blue, is the penultimate track, I think, he says, with confidence. And I was aware at the start of it that, I had been emotional during the performance, and, you know, Elton's a few seats down, and Joni, and Brandi Carlile, and, you know, Marilyn Manson's in front of me, Kevin Bacon's a couple of rows down, you know, Minnie Driver. It was, you know, it was like, it was an amazing atmosphere in this room. I'm sat next to Bernie Taupin, who's become a really good friend. And I was aware that I was a little bit emotional at the start of A Case of You. And I thought, well, that's fine. You know, I'm millennial. I'm, you know, comfortable with my feelings. I'm good. And as the second verse, and it goes, I am a lonely painter. I live in a box of paint. And I don't know what it was. I could not. I was blubbing like a seal. I just went, and I was trying. It's a really public room, and people are aware that you're in there.
Right.
And so I'm, you know, covering my mouth like this and trying to hold it together. But it was like I couldn't. It was just this incredibly, overwhelming feeling of just. I don't even know what it was. It was, of course, sad. There's a melancholy to the song, but it was more just, it's the only time in my life where people, you know, when people just cry at beauty, I just, it was just that this is just so heart-stoppingly beautiful, and I couldn't contain it. And people started handing me tissues, and I was so embarrassed. And
And you looked over at Joni.
I couldn't look at Joni. I was so embarrassed. I couldn't look at Joni. But but everyone knew it was happening because I couldn't, crying, shaking my body, and but it was amazing. But it makes me think of another Joni lyric, and it is laughing and crying, you know, it's the same release. And I felt bloody amazing afterwards. I really felt amazing. I felt like I'd expelled something. I felt light.
It's sort of the same endorphins are going.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And it just really made sense of that lyric. I don't know, it was a weird night, weird week of seeing Joni Mitchell, this very and just being around Joni Mitchell and feeling like I did an Instagram post afterwards about Brandy's gig because I loved it so much, and I said in it, and I did, I felt like I knew myself a little better afterwards, and that sounds so utterly wanky, but it is how I felt.
No, that's what music does to you.
Yeah,
you're playing one of the greatest musicians of all time, and you know, you could listen to his songs over and over again, and they get you every single time. And you
totally,
and especially, you know, as you get older, you're hearing lyrics that you didn't hear when you were 16 years old.
Of course, yeah, of course. But yes, so yeah, all was good. Yeah,
Taron, thank you so much.
Thank
this is
you
awesome.
Very, very much.
This is
thank
great.
You.
Thank
great.
You.
Thanks, man.
That was Rocket Man star Taron Egerton. Coming up after the break, Aldous Hodge. I sat down with a Clemency actor at the SCAD Savannah Film Festival to find out how he prepared to play an inmate on death row by visiting San Quentin. Stick around. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's Clemency star, Aldous Hodge.
How are you?
I'm doing fine, man. How you doing?
Yeah?
Yes.
Have you been to, you've been to Savannah before, yeah?
I have. Because
you're from down here. Aren't you in North Carolina?
Well, I was born in North Carolina, yeah. We shot Underground the second season here.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. So that was my first, I think it was 2016, but that was the first time that I had been at SCAD. That was my introduction to SCAD.
Yeah.
Film Fest. I was like, well, this is serious business. I mean, it ain't going all out. And this place, like, this is my jam, man. It's all colorful. Cause like I paint and I design a whole bunch of different things. Like art is my language through and through. So this is the library and like it's colorful. They got cool rooms. They got little swingy chairs. Like, you know what I mean? I could kick it here for a minute.
You're in your element.
Yeah, I used to go to a design school back in California, Art Center, College of Design. And I don't know, man. I love a place that just, when you walk in, you feel the vibe and it inspires you to do what you naturally are here to do.
So what kind of painting do you do?
I suppose abstract. I'm getting a little bit more into portraiture, trying to practice that a bit more. I need the time to do it. Right. You know, I'm going to go home and finish taking care of my little setup in the back.
Yeah.
Because I'm traveling so much these days, I don't have time to be consistent. But regardless, I still love it. And it's something that I love pursuing. I would make it a job if I could.
Where did your love of art come from?
It was just innate since I was a child. I remember my mom used to get mad at me because I'd be like 1 or 2 years old drawing on her white couch with her red lipstick. And she'd be
like,
bro.
That's me.
Yeah.
No, I did. Yeah. Downstairs from me, I'm one day after school playing with the landlord's kid. And she's like, oh, I'm allowed to draw on the walls.
Yeah.
And we went and started drawing on the walls. She was not allowed to be drawing on the walls.
My mom was, she was not a fan then. She's a fan now. She gets it. She understands now. But it's one of those things that was natural. My interest in how I see the world is through art. It's a visual experience, sensory experience. My language is art. That's how I communicate with people because I was not naturally verbally communicative. I was always very much a quiet child and observer.
So let's talk about Clemency.
Yes, indeed.
So did you get sent the script? How did it come about?
Yes, my Chinoya, the director and writer, she sent my team the script. Her and Bronwyn Cornelius, our producer. So my team sent me the script, and Chinoya also wrote a letter to me speaking on her support of me in the role and what she thought I could bring to it. And it was a very, very beautifully worded letter. And after I read the script, I saw a massive potential for an opportunity to do some really great work because of how she wrote it. I was truly impressed with the duality of the situation, the characters, what they went through, the exploration of the context and the subject matter, how it wasn't preachy. It wasn't, you know, she lays out a situation and doesn't give the audience or force upon the audience her own ideas of an answer. She just poses a question and the audience is left to answer that for themselves, which is what I love, because I like going to movies and having experiences that make me think.
Right.
You know, and I go home saying, well, all right, well, what would I do in this situation? So for the way that she illustrated the script and then how we came to shooting this thing, it was fantastic. Plus, knowing that I had the opportunity to work alongside Alfre Woodard, you know, she's a screen legend. That for me was bananas, because I want to continually put myself in a position to grow and work with other artists who are going to help me get there. And, you know, Chinoya and Alfre were definitely that. And then you hear about the rest of the cast. You know, we got Richard Schiff, Wendell Pierce, Danielle Brooks, Michael O'Neill.
Danielle, I love Danielle so much.
Oh, man, she's awesome.
The first time I met her actually was through SCAD, but up in Atlanta for the TV festival.
Okay,
yes,
gotcha.
Orange is the New Black had just hit.
Yeah, man. She's fantastic. And I love well, I don't want to give away the cookies,
gotcha.
But the scene that we have is one of the scenes that locked in my decision to do this.
Wow.
Yeah, because the conversation, they have the context. You know, I feel like Danielle's character is really brave in that she gives many truths about how she feels, whereas in real life, I think it's what people would want to say but may not have the courage to say. Mm-hmm. And she goes there, and Chinoya, just, she wrote the hell out of that scene. Right. And that was something I was really excited about, because I said, I can't wait for people to see this, man.
Yeah. So let's back up. Give me the give me the log line of the movie.
Let's see. Log line is tough, but I know. I will paraphrase from Chinoya's words, in that this film is an exploration into the effects on those whose livelihood is tied to the task of taking life. Mm-hmm. And meaning that we're exploring the effects of the death row sentence, the act of it, through the eyes of Bernadine, who's played expertly by Alfre Woodard, and she's a prison warden, and this is her job. But taking life is what pays her bills, and she has to see this every day, and she's trying to hold on to her humanity. She's trying to give these men dignity, and we see how that affects her. We see how death row impacts the families around people. We see how it impacts the people that work there.
Right.
The PTSD rate for people that work in prisons and in death row, the rate is equal or equivalent to people who are coming back from war.
Wow.
Yeah, it's insane, man. So, the way she goes about it, then we also explore what that effect is when it comes to my character, Anthony Woods, who is on death row, has been for about 15 years at this point, and he's fighting for clemency. The best that he can get in terms of clemency is to not die, a line that is expertly delivered by Richard Schiff. He said, "When I win, my clients get to not die."
Wow.
And we see what that reality is for people. Mm. So I think that the film has a great potential to be able to help people engage a real conversation about the complicit nature with which we stand on death row, and how we can be more active about it.
Because the film doesn't take a side.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
It does not take a side, which is the best thing about it.
Right.
Doesn't take a side, doesn't get preachy, it doesn't impose upon you a specific opinion. It basically asks you, all right, now that you've seen the truth of this, how do you feel? What do you think about this?
Right. And chances are it's not going to be so black and white.
Exactly. It's not.
So how do you even prepare to play a man on death row? Do you do a deep dive? Do you know, enough television, so-called reality shows about this? I mean, you put on the History Channel, you put on any of these channels now, and it's constantly there.
You got it. I would say go to the reality of it. Yeah. So Chinoya first told me about the case of Troy Davis, a man who was actually executed here in Georgia. And she gave me a book about that, about his life and what he went through. Because when Troy Davis was executed, there was an outpouring of support and mostly a lot of letters written from wardens talking about how, you know, they were in support of him gaining clemency. They were talking about the mental effects that it has on people who are in this position, people who work, and that's what sort of inspired her thinking about how to write this film and why, you know, she wanted to write it in the first place. But so it gives you a whole different perspective. And then I went to San Quentin with our producer Bronwyn Cornelius.
You did.
And I observed the brothers who were sitting there. We were given a tour of the facility by the brothers who were serving life sentences. Now, I went with the intent to talk to the brothers on death row, but I was not allowed to per the warden's restrictions. We were not allowed to engage with them, even to the point where when they were transferred across the yard, the other inmates were made to turn their backs and not speak to them and not look at them. So there was such an isolated environment created for them all the way down to their last breath that really informed my idea of what my character might be going through. It was nearly inhumane to a degree. It was very shocking to experience. But I think that when it comes to preparing for these situations, I mean, how do you prepare for somebody potentially saying, okay, today's the day you're going to die?
Right.
My character didn't know what that was, nor did I. So I wanted to experience it with my character as I experienced it through my character.
So what is a tour like San Quentin like? When you, I mean, is there a part of you that I would think sort of you're there, it's almost, what's the word? You're taking a tour, you know you could leave. Is it almost like, I don't know if I should be even be doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a real sense of, there's a newfound appreciation for the idea of freedom. Mm-hmm. Things that we take for granted on a regular basis.
Right.
I mean, we toured, the warden showed us the death chamber. The men who are on death row, oftentimes they get an option as to how they would like to die. Mm-hmm. And he asked us, now, what percentage do you think do they choose this option or that option? Right. You know, we were like, well, we don't know. We can't say. He said, most of the time they don't choose. Because how do you choose?
How do you choose? Right.
Which way you're going to? And oddly enough, crazy enough, there's still so many different ways. Gas chamber, there's the needle, intravenous drugs. There's still electric chair in some places, hanging. There's even a firing squad in one state. And I was like, are you insane? Yes. So it really opens your eyes to the barbaric nature with which we shroud the idea of justice in. And you know, it pushes you to do more, which is why I did the film. Hopefully there can be some conversations around how we eradicate this disease we know to be the death row sentence. Yeah, so when I was doing a little research there and asking around, and I was asking specifically how this disproportionately affects different communities, because we already know how it disproportionately affects Black and Americans who are Black and of Hispanic descent. And when it came to death row, it was less about the color of the offender, but more the color of the victim. In terms of Black and brown bodies, not much credence is given. When it comes to the death row sentence, in almost all cases, when you're white, death row. If the victim is white,
whoa.
Yeah. Just another notch on the belt of pushing the agenda, and that white lives matter to some people more than Black and brown lives, which is staggering, insulting, and appalling. But again, a film like this to call to light what is going on out there is it gives me purpose and a reason and real substance when it comes to my art and my craft. And I love to be a part of effective things. I call it effective art.
What were the rehearsals, the first reads like, the first table reads?
We actually didn't do.
Really?
We shot this in 17 days.
What?
I shot all of my work in 5 days.
Okay, I know this is only audio right now. My mouth is on the floor.
Yeah, man. 17 days, brother. That's what you call preparation. Chinoya was not playing.
Whoa.
Chinoya was like, she had been doing the research for 4 years prior to filming this. She had volunteered, I think, on 14 different cases, all of which were women. She even started a screenwriting program within prisons to help inmates write their scripts and get them on screen. Alfred Woodard was on the project 2 years before we started filming, so their hearts were in it, the research was there. And when it came to shooting, she was just ready to go. Man, you had to show up ready. We didn't shoot long. I mean,
dumbfounded right now.
Yeah.
7 days.
7 days, 7 days. You know what? She told me something that I hadn't even realized. But in the film, the scene between Alfrey and I, where Alfrey is explaining to my character how he's going to die, we shot that in 2 takes.
Wow. Aldous, thank you so much.
Thank you, brother.
That was Aldous Hodge. Clemency will be in theaters on December 27th. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Big Ticket. Coming up next week, Bombshell star Margot Robbie and Sterling K. Brown. He's talking about his new indie Waves and what it's like to be a part of Frozen 2. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mark Malkin. See you next week.